Hi, this is Nancy Clare, and welcome to episode 81 of Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest is Trudy Nan Boyce, whose debut crime fiction novel, Out of the Blues, is being released Tuesday, February 23rd. Her procedural featuring Sarah Ault, nicknamed Salt because that was what was on her name badge, her first initial and last name, when she was a beat cop, begins on Salt's first day as a detective in Homicide. For fans of crime fiction, I think it's exciting when a new writer comes on the scene, especially when it's the first of a series, which Out of the Blues is. Trudy's character, Salt's relationship with her city, Atlanta, and her abiding love of the blues reminds me of Michael Connelly's Bosch and his relationship with Los Angeles and love of jazz. Out of the Blues is a procedural that is informed by Atlanta, the city in which it is set, and framed by the music that courses through the characters, the story, and the city. Here's Trudy Nan Boyce. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I am so excited to be talking to Trudy Nan Boyce, whose first crime fiction novel, Out of the Blues, is due for publication on Tuesday, February 23rd. Welcome, Trudy.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad to be with you.
Well, I'm always excited to talk to a writer who is publishing his or her first book. So first of all, congratulations, because it's not an easy thing to do.
Thank you so much. It's been an exciting ride so far, and I feel very, very fortunate. I'm very grateful to Penguin and my agent, Matt Sobel. So it's been a great fun ride.
Which leads me into my first question, which is, You come to crime fiction late in your career, it's not like like grass is growing under your feet here. You have a doctorate in community counseling, and oh, by the way, you spent 30 years with the Atlanta Police Force, rising from beat cop to homicide detective to hostage negotiator and lieutenant. So there's a lot of things you could have done at this point. Why did you turn to fiction in general and crime fiction in particular?
Well, I didn't set out to write at all, really, actually. It's a bit of a story, but in 2001, I was working as a sergeant in a unit that investigated crimes against children. So it was my responsibility every day to go in and collect the reports from the field and to get reports from child services about children who had been sexually abused or physically abused or run away or missing, and to read those reports, some 40 reports every morning, and to assign them to my detectives. That took a toll, so much of a toll, I guess, is when the planes flew into the buildings, some of my crew called me and said, come to the room and look at this, what's going on. And I looked, and then I went back, right back to my reports, because I had my own tragedies right there in front of me. So, as you might imagine, that took a toll. My marriage came apart. And at the end of 2001, my best friend of more than 30 years died of breast cancer, and we'd been the kind of friends where you call each other on the phone every day, see each other a couple times a week. We'd been through marriages and divorces and birth of children, and I had been involved with her care because she died at home, and she had two little children. So it was a year of tragedies for me, and so when she died, I knew that I was going to need an outlet, and so she had been a burgeoning writer, and so I signed up for a creative writing course. I didn't need more university credits, but there we have a lovely fine arts center called Callenwall here in Atlanta, and I signed up for a creative writing course just because I thought that would be fun and a way to use my energies. And the first exercise, you know, they have these exercises that you do, and the first exercise that we were asked to do was to describe following someone. So I had a bit of a leg up on that one, having followed some people.
You definitely had an advantage over the other members of your class.
Right. So, but I flashed immediately on this. You know, writers sometimes talk about widowed images, and images we all have, memories, snippets of memories, pieces of memory, often from our childhood that are not particularly connected to much. But I immediately flashed to a night that I was on patrol, and in Atlanta we work one-man units. We're single-man patrol cars, and so I was on in a really kind of destitute neighborhood in the shadow of Turner Fields, where every other lot was vacant and the houses were dilapidated, some inhabited and some not, and on a very small street where the street lights had been mostly shot out and you could hear people fighting down the street. And so I'm with flow patrol with the windows down because you can see and hear and taste things coming on better than if the windows are up. And so this woman jumps out of the shadows and right in front of my patrol car. Good thing I was slow patrol. And she's what the street people call, this is kind of the height of the crack epidemic, the street people call here in Atlanta, they call a geek monster. Somebody whose life has been pretty much given over to trying to get drugs, crack, for a drug addiction. And so she runs over to my side of the car, and she's all perky-jerky and kind of skin and bones and tube top and patchy hair. And she says, you've got to help me. And I said, what's going on? She said, my man, you've got to help me find him because I cut him. He's cut. He's bleeding. He's walking around, and he's bleeding. And I said, well, you know, what happened? She said, we just always fight. We're always fighting. And I said, well, why do you stay together? And she kind of jumped, ran in front of the patrol car and kind of grabbed her crotch, and she's dancing. She said, it's because he loves my Poudre pot pie. And so that stuck with me as it might, and I wrote the story, and as if we had jointly, I'd gotten her in the car, and we'd gone to find him, and we did find him in my fictionalized story of her. She became, her counterpart, became central to this series of crime novels that I'm writing, as well as did her family, her daughter, her mother, her man, and her son, all populated this work that I'm doing. It happened kind of spontaneously. I really didn't set out to write. I set out to have an outlet, I guess. And I've received a lot of encouragement with that first piece about following the guy. And it was just a fascinating process for me that I could recapture and these moments in the street. Anise Nin said that we write to taste life twice. And that has certainly been true for me, to be able to explore those moments in the street of extreme joy and creativity that are certainly in the street, and as well as the tragedies. Other people have said that we write to try to understand. And that's been another gift, is being able to explore how many things how problems in the street developed. So that's kind of a long answer to your question. But it came to me more than anything else, I guess. Set out purposefully.
You introduce your protagonist, Sarah Ault, who is called Salt because that's how it's spelled out with her first initial and her last name. So you introduce Salt to the readers on the day she reports to homicide after her promotion from beat cop. So we have to wonder how much of Trudy Nan Boyce is in Sarah Ault.
Well, certainly what Sarah experiences, many of her experiences were inspired by things that I experienced. But she's younger. She's taller. She's probably more tragically affected because her father has committed suicide. My father did not. He lived to be 87 years old and was really a wonderful father. And so she's had more tragedy. But I guess we do share some similarities. I certainly cared about the people that I worked among. And I did patrol, like Salt, I did patrol the most densely populated housing project on Evening Watch for a number of years. And so in that way, we're similar. And many of the incidents in the people, are, of course, are amalgams of people I met in the street and people I worked with. And so in that way, the books do represent some of the things that I experienced.
I read an advanced reader's copy of the book, and in my arc there was your note to the booksellers. And in this note you point out that while in the rural South of not so long ago, it was the preacher who, you point out, your father was a preacher, that people would call on when someone had a crisis. And today, in the poverty-stricken urban neighborhoods in cities like Atlanta, where your book is set, it's the cop who gets that call. And Salt understands that burden, but do you think her coworkers do in the novel?
I certainly think some of them do, and they have to protect themselves. And I think that's one of Salt's flaws, is that she doesn't really know where to draw the line, and sometimes works way too close to the people in the street, and that gets her into tight situations. So it's really a double-edged sword, is that because she works so close, she's able to find out information and to understand things, while on the other hand, it does make it more dangerous for her. And I think that in general that cops do more to a lesser or greater degree work very close to the street or not so close to the street. And I always thought it was, for me anyway, it was to my advantage both from an understanding perspective and being able to find out what's going on. But also it was protective in a way, too, because if people feel like you're on their side, they're going to give you information and also watch out for you. And I always thought that was a wonderful thing. And I had a lot of people that I talked to on the street when I was a beat cop, solved a murder before I ever went to homicide, because a street whore gave me some information about a recent murder, and she had a run-in with the perpetrator, and she wasn't sure, but she had heard about the murder, and what this guy did to her was so similar. She told me where he lived. She didn't know his name, and we were able to do a little street investigation, and we had to find out he had just gotten out of prison for a very violent rape. So it was certainly to my advantage and the community's advantage for me to work very closely with folks.
Well, that's interesting because, and this isn't a spoiler, but on Salt's first case, and when she reports to the Homicide Bureau, she solves her first case, which is both a blessing and a curse in a way, because when she gets back, she's given a cold case, which sort of leads me to my next question about your book's called Out of the Blues, and music in general and the blues in particular seem to provide an organizational framework for a lot of the story. The victim in this cold case that Salt is given as her official greeting to homicide was a blues musician. And many of the witnesses of that case, as well as witnesses in the active case she becomes involved with during the course of the novel, are musicians as well. Is there a reason, though, that you chose the world of blues music as opposed to country music or rock and roll or roots rock or something like that?
Well, the blues, for me, represents the soul of America, really. It's the only art form that is original to our country. And I think that a lot of people really don't understand that. They don't understand the contributions of blues to our American culture. And so I felt like that investigating the murder of a blues musician was a vehicle to for me to look at the blues scene here in Atlanta and a vehicle to understanding the culture of Atlanta as well. The blues really is something is a music that runs through the city and came out of this was a crossroads for the blues as well as a crossroads for the nation. Atlanta in itself has no natural geographical gifts. It was built around the railroad. And slaves really built the railroads. And then after the Civil War, much of the male black population was arrested. Many black men were arrested on trumped-up charges and conscripted into labor for the railroads and for other industries in the city, brick-making. And so, again, it was black people and the black culture that this city was built on the back of. And, of course, the blues came out of field hollers and work songs, which were a way for people to express themselves while they were working, while they were doing hard work. So it really was the blues was a way to explore that, and also a way to look at how much of that has been buried and not appreciated on both sides, because people didn't really want to look at their poverty roots or their lack where they came from a lot of the times on both sides of the track. So that was an interesting way for me to open up that particular aspect of the city that I love very much, but I think it's it doesn't do any of us any good. We don't appreciate what we've got if we don't know where we've come from.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because you also address race in the book in a very interesting way. It's through an African-American character who has moved to Atlanta. She's the wife of Salt's partner, who is called Pepper, which is, I think, is fantastic. And she engages Salt, who's white, in discussions about race relations in Atlanta. And I wonder, are these discussions still the elephant in the room that no one talks about?
I think they are. I think they certainly are often. And we're the nation of people saying we need to have these conversations. And we seem to not be able to find our way into these conversations. It was refreshing to me to come across Anne, and she just says whatever she wants to say, because she's not afraid to tiptoe around it, whereas Southerners, for a lot of reasons, both on both sides, black and white, I think are often reluctant to open that can of worms and or don't have a way into that. So Anne is a great character for initiating those kinds of discussions.
Well, it also made Salt a little bit more thoughtful, because sometimes when you're very, very close to something, you might not necessarily see it through the eyes of someone who has moved from somewhere else.
Yeah, and I think that she's also, that is another thing about Salt, is that she intuitively understands a lot of the anguish around that. But again, she's been raised in a culture that doesn't actively talk about those things. And for me, some of the other characters that, for example, her neighbor, Mr. Gooden, is, for me, it was kind of an old South kind of guy, good at heart, but he says, you know, we don't talk about that stuff. So all of that was really interesting for me to explore, and I'm still interested in it. And Atlanta is a city that gives up its mysteries piece by piece and neighborhood by neighborhood. And I've lived and worked in this city for a long, long time. I went to university in this university that's right downtown. I live in a downtown neighborhood. I take advantage of the city's parks and pools, and I love the city. But it's not been until I was writing these books that I really began to understand some more things about this book, about this city, which is fascinating for me.
You also have an important character in the story who suffers from mental illness. And that, I thought her, the way she was portrayed was very sympathetic. And it made me wonder how difficult it is for you to draw, or was for you to draw, a three-dimensional character who is mentally ill and not succumb to stereotype.
Well, because I have known a lot of people who lived in the street and the agony that they go through. One of the things that I'm proudest of is program that we developed for training officers in managing people in crisis who have a mental illness, de-escalation skills. And, of course, that's a lot in the news, where officers have been involved in deadly force situations with people who are mentally ill. And this is based on the CIT model that came out of Memphis. And it was a very powerful experience for me teaching those. And it was very powerful for the officers who were in that class. And I had so many of them say to me after the class, if only I had known how to do this when that situation happened, or if only I had known this when I got suspended. So those kinds of experiences were very powerful for me. And also, on one of the other programs that I'm very proud of, we had a team of officers, and they're actually in the book, the HOPE team, who did worked in our homeless community, trying to do outreach to bring people into services. And, of course, the vast majority of those people who are in the street because they have a severe and persistent mental illness, whether that's an addiction or depression. So working with those officers very closely with people and getting to know people's tragedies, the agony that they're in when they're decompensating, when they have these voices in their head that they – some of them know are not real, but they can't get rid of and they can't manage. When they are in a broken mental health system, that, for example, you go into the city hospital, which doesn't have the resources, but these people with schizophrenia or bipolar go into the hospital and get a prescription and are told to come back in 2 or 3 weeks and told to take their medication with their meals, and they go right back into the street where they have no regular meals, they don't have water, and they have no freaking idea what day it is, much less what week it is. So it's a huge tragedy in our nation. It's a shame. So police officers see that heartbreak every day. It's very close to my heart. You can tell I get a little emotional about that. So, and officers often have no recourse except to take people to jail. And sometimes jail ends up being the safest place for them because at least they receive consistent medical care and their medications can be monitored. So that's a real tragedy. That's a shame. A lot of people don't realize that our largest population of institutionalized mentally ill people are Cook County in Chicago and our own Fulton County Jail here in Atlanta. That's a tragedy. There's something wrong there. Writing fiction gave me the opportunity to explore that and to talk about that in a way that's not in your face, but helps. I hope that the character in Out of the Blues, who was suffering from a chronic mental illness and living in the street, was somebody that people could empathize with. It was really important to me for that. And I've often said that police officers really are often the canaries in the mine of our social problems. It's there that those crises get played out between law enforcement and people who are desperate.
Well, you also mentioned before that you know, one of the things that members of the police department in Atlanta and everywhere I would expect have to do is take care of themselves. And so one of the things you bring up in the book is that Atlanta police don't make very much money, and to make ends meet often necessitates taking a second job, which opens up a potential for conflict of interest. So it was an important part of your story. It was interesting to me because as a non-member of the police, of any police department, it was something that had never really occurred to me. So is that it? But I take it that's something that takes place.
It does. And my friends in law enforcement will not appreciate me bringing this issue up, I think. I had really the luxury of not having to work extra jobs because for a lot of reasons. But many of my colleagues felt compelled to work extra jobs so that they could live in outside the city, in the suburbs, where they had access to good schools and where they had access to affordable housing. I was able to live in the city and didn't have to worry about public schools. So, if we paid officers a decent salary, maybe a stipend to be able to live in the city, we could do something about extra jobs. We could gradually, hopefully, reduce the number of hours that officers are allowed to work or where they're allowed to work. We already do have some policies and procedures regarding that. But I have just seen too many officers work themselves into fatigue. And I felt like they often couldn't be sharp to be on their regular shift. And I think it's detrimental to relationships, to their marriages, to their children. Here they are working all these hours to give their children opportunities, but the biggest thing that the children need is time with their parents. We want police officers to be invested in the communities, but we sure make it pretty hard for them to live in the communities.
Your book does, without being preachy or without hitting readers over the head, it's a very, very good window into the life of the police and law enforcement and what they have to do, as well as a window into your city, which, you know, for many of us, especially in the north part of the country or the west where I live, is something we don't see. You know, maybe we've visited Atlanta, but as you said, you've lived there for years and years, and you're still discovering its mysteries.
I am. It's a much more soulful place than people really understand, I think, because the city has gone out of its way to be all this boosterism of the city, and they extol the virtues of commerce and the entertainment industry and the movie industry and the music industry, when really I think there are really many more basic things to understand about the city. One of the most poignant moments I ever had was one day when I was on foot patrol, and this was even after I was a lieutenant. I felt it was important to walk the walk as well as talk the talk. And so it was on Auburn Avenue, which was historically was the heart of the black community and one of the most affluent black communities in the nation, 30s, 40s. So, and had a wonderful music scene there, too, in 50s and 60s. The Royal Peacock, some of the biggest names in rhythm and blues and rock and roll, played at the Royal Peacock. B.B. King, Howlin' Wolf, Little Richard. That was the Royal Peacock at the height of its glory, and Auburn Avenue, a bustling commercial African American community. But so I'm on street patrol now. They're trying to do a resurgence in the area. There are some things that are happening, but it completely went to rack and ruin, and many of the old beautiful buildings were torn down. Some of them survived, but so I'm walking in the street, and I see this old man sitting on the curb, and I stopped to talk to him, and I sat down on the curb, and we started talking about the music. And he had this amazing, he looked down the street toward the Royal Peacock, and he got this incredible wistful look in his eye, and you could see how amazing that it, and how much it had meant to him at one time. It was a very personal experience, and how grieving for that lost time. So it's moments like that that were the stimulus for me to try to uncover and discover what we have lost and what is still there about the city. And it is, much of it is still there. You just have to look in the right places.
Well, that brings me to what's traditionally my last question of these interviews, and you have a character that's going to recur. So what is next for Salt? What's her next adventure? What mystery is she going to peel back and share with your readers?
Well, she's still in homicide, and she will be investigating murders, a murder, and the city will certainly play a major role in that. There are a lot of things that I was interested in exploring in the next work, and they have to do with, of course, from the headlines and from the disturbances that we've had in the use of force, and how our communities react to that and how they handle it to some better than others, and how we got to this point in our relationships with one another. So all those things and the cities, more mysteries from the city. The city continues to disclose its mysteries and tragedies and its wonderful things about the city as well.
Well, thank you for talking to us about Sarah Ault and Out of the Blues. And does the next work have a title yet that you can share?
All we have is a working title right now, so I'm not sure.
I'll just look forward to it. Thank you so much for joining us, Trudy. I'm just so excited about this book, and I really want everybody who listens to this podcast to go out and get it. It's just a refreshing new voice in the world of procedurals.
Thank you, Nancy. I appreciate it.